You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Koutou katoa, ko kasta toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to the Wire Wharahina Monday. I'm your host Kasta, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Alex. If I can, coming up on the show, for our weekly catch up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about liquid natural gas imports and David Seymour's State of the Nation speech yesterday. I also spoke to Professor Emeritus at Massey University, Ralph Sims, about the sustainability of a liquid natural gas terminal. I also spoke to the University of Auckland's Professor of Electrical Engineering, Nirmal Nair, about how the LNG plans would benefit power companies. Alex, what have you got for us today?
I spoke to Professor Emeritus in Law at the University of Auckland, Jane Kelsey, about the ongoing rumblings around reforms within the World Trade Organization, New Zealand's role, and what changes to the organization would mean for us. I also spoke with Professor in Chemicals and Materials Engineering at the University of Auckland and Deputy Director of the Green Energy Engineering Centre, Brent Young, about the government's liquid natural gas terminal proposal and what it means in the context of our wider approach to fixing our energy woes.
He aha o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or ai mai rānei, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kawa e wareware e ahana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō. Hei pakihere rukiruki mā runga i te pai, tukutuku o irirangi poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more as always by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
This past week has seen the government announcing plans to construct a facility for the storage of liquid natural gas. The plans have been criticised by activists, academics and opposition members who say it compromises our government's commitment to reducing emissions. Yesterday also saw David Seymour, ACT Party leader, making a speech on his thoughts on the state of the nation. The speech concluded with his stance that ACT believes there are 5 warning lights on the dashboard of New Zealand society and economy that must be overcome. For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court, I spoke to him about each of these issues, starting with the liquid natural gas terminal. I wanted to start off with the liquid natural gas stuff that the government's been talking about a lot recently. Why is this policy coming into place from the government's point of view?
Well, the reality is that when gas isn't available, the system often falls back on coal, and the modelling that the government's relied on to make this investment indicates that simply having reliable standby supply in the form of gas will take pressure off power prices and long-term reduce our reliance on coal. So from ACT's perspective, it's a really sensible resilience measure for now. But the long-term goal, of course, should still be restoring confidence in developing New Zealand's own indigenous gas resources so that we're less reliant on imports.
$1 billion, right? That's a lot of money to get this going. And the ACT Party's been talking over the past few years and moving up to this election as well about cutting government spend and reducing what it's doing there. How is this getting rationalised, this amount of money?
Well, in the end, it's consumers and energy users who are going to have to contribute to this cost. The modelling does show that in the long run, having greater security of supply will mean that we won't see these crazy peaks of short-term power prices rising to $800 a megawatt hour as they have in the past couple of years. And at the long run price sits somewhere between 160 and 200, which is reasonable. People can invest on that basis. But look, this is the cost of Jacinda Ardern and that 2017 to 2020 Labor-led government cancelling oil and gas exploration. We're now in a shortage because if you don't keep drilling, if you don't keep developing your well fields and bringing gas online as fields age out, then you end up with no gas. I mean, that's just physics. And cancelling oil and gas exploration before having an alternative like an LNG terminal built was one of those kind of virtue signalling absolutely crazy policies that all Kiwis have paid for through their energy bills over the past 6 years or so. Look, so it's not ideal, but that's the situation this government inherited and we're turning it around.
Yeah, I want to get back to that in a moment, but first I want to talk about the price of this again. You say the cost is going to go on to consumers. The ACT Party's campaigned on, you know, cutting taxes, reducing the amount that people are paying for government services. Isn't this directly antithetical to the party's policies?
Well, this is not a government service. This is the government investing in infrastructure that all energy users and consumers will contribute towards. So, look, there are alternatives. The government has hundreds of billions of dollars worth of assets, including $12 billion worth, approximately, invested in existing electricity generators. What ACT would do, if it was up to us, is actually recycle that capital out of, say, Mercury, Genesis, and Meridian into new assets that we need. That's been ACT's policy for a long time, and I expect we'll be campaigning very hard to do that in this upcoming election. Because instead of borrowing money to pay for stuff, if you've already got stuff that you could sell, and put that money into new infrastructure, that makes a lot of sense to Kiwis.
I want to get back to now the ban on oil and gas exploration. The government, the ACT Party as well, have been criticising this ban basically since it was announced. The issue there is that we're trying to phase out oil and gas, obviously, and you've mentioned that...
It's not obvious at all. That is a completely irrational thing to do.
No, from a climate change point of view, I mean, we should be reducing our emissions, no? It's a logical thing to do.
Well, countries all have to pick their own path. But in the end, countries that choose to phase out or ban certain fuels because they're trying to achieve a climate ambition that makes their citizens poorer and actually increases their vulnerability to energy shocks, that country's not going to do well in the long run. That's why we've seen around the world countries that have made ambitious, over-ambitious, you know, dramatic commitments to reduce emissions are finding actually, like the UK, that their energy costs are the highest in the world. It's crippling their economy and destroying jobs, and you know, that can't continue. So ACT's always said that's what would happen. It did happen, and now we're fixing it.
Right, I'd like to counter that a little bit. You say that countries that transition out of oil and gas into renewable energy won't face good outcomes in the long run. However, also, countries that are island nations, surrounded by rising sea levels, surrounded by extreme weather conditions, are going to face similarly bad conditions in a climate-ravaged world. Is that not something we should consider when making these decisions?
I think it's important that we keep these things separate. If countries want to reduce their emissions by becoming more efficient and, you know, switching from coal to gas or gas to electricity, then they should do that. We need to be very clear about where New Zealand is up to right now. We have much higher energy costs than we did six or so years ago. That has meant that large industries have closed, that people are out of jobs, and that even the cost of making bread, making pies, growing vegetables, actually supplying fertilizer into the market, which, you know, New Zealand actually makes fertilizer from natural gas here at Balance and Kapuni. All of these input costs have gone up. That's why New Zealanders are feeling a cost of living crisis continues for many. And so we've got to separate these things. Of course, we must have a climate policy that, you know, sets out a pathway to reducing our emissions intensity, but that cannot possibly be at the expense of New Zealanders' well-being.
I want to move on now to David Seymour's State of the Nation speech from yesterday. A lot of things in the speech. I want to start off at the focus on youth. He talks a lot about how young people are not feeling confident in the economy, in society, in Aotearoa, and are moving overseas to places like Australia for better wages and whatnot. Is the government, you know, we've seen cuts to benefits for young people, we've seen record unemployment. Is the government really providing that much for young people at the moment?
Well, David's speech was very clear. There are warning lights flashing all over New Zealand's dashboard. We've got weak productivity. We've got rising cost pressures. We've just been talking about energy costs. And too many young people are questioning, you know, whether their future is here. Now, these pressures stem from a succession of governments that have become too large, too expensive, and too slow to deliver results. Now, government currently makes up about 40% of the spend in New Zealand. And David also warned against a drift to those divisive anti-success politics that focuses on blame, sees everything as a zero-sum game. These people are wealthy because you are not. If we take their wealth and redistribute it, if we tax landlords and, you know, rent will get cheaper. Look, none of those policies have worked anywhere in the world that they've been tried. They certainly haven't worked in New Zealand under previous regimes. And that's why David set out an alternative, you know, a structural reset of the machinery of government, cut the number of ministers to no more than 20, reduce the number of departments to no more than 30, and basically ensure accountability for each part of government that we actually need only reports to a single minister. That's a starter for 10. That's what we'll be campaigning on this year.
There's also a bit in here about, I'm just going to read this quote. It is not just that inflation has driven up costs, it is that wages have not kept up with inflation. It's a very clear quote from David there, criticising the fact that wages haven't gone up enough. Is this the ACT Party committing to, you know, increasing the minimum wage this election?
Well, it's not the minimum wage that's the problem. In fact, the minimum wage went up by about 30% more than inflation under the previous Labor, Greens and government, going back to 2017 to 2023. But employers who can't afford to pay it simply don't hire those workers. And what we also see is that unless productivity, in fact, the output that each worker produces per hour increases at least as fast as the wage rates increase, all that happens is all New Zealanders get poorer. So the focus has to be on increasing productivity, whether that's investment in plant and equipment, you know, buying new construction equipment, buying new manufacturing equipment, investing in the latest technology in food service, for example, AI, which, you know, I've read reports and have contributed potentially to a 0.5 or 1% increase in GDP in the US in the last year. And we're only just getting started with AI. We have to become more productive. Government has to become more productive and much leaner as well.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court speaking to me about liquid natural gas proposals and the ACT Party leader David Seymour's State of the Nation speech.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
Doesn't give my opponents much time to run up to an election, does it?
The Wire.
Over the course of the latest Trump administration, numerous international organizations have found themselves in the president's crosshairs. The latest is the World Trade Organization, with the US bandying about a set of reforms that would consolidate their influence over the organization and reduce the limitations placed upon them. I spoke with Professor Emeritus in Law at the University of Auckland, Jane Kelsey, about these reforms, particularly in regards to how New Zealand is positioning ourselves in these changes and what they'll mean for us. Just to get us started, as it stands, how kind of does the WTO operate for countries like New Zealand?
The WTO, when it was set up in 1995, was meant to set global rules for how countries trade with each other. And those rules have always been set by the bigger, more powerful players. But for countries like New Zealand, the rule that each country should get the same benefits and have the same standing and authority in the organisation was seen as giving New Zealand as a small country a better deal than if it was trying to do it all on its own, just one by one with other countries.
So what then We're currently looking at the Trump administration bringing forth sort of changes to how the WTO is run. What actually are these changes?
As people will have seen, President Trump has come in and kind of thrown a grenade into many international spaces, including into the trade space, by saying if other countries don't give him what he wants, he will impose taxes on their goods as they come into the US. Those are known as tariffs. And that's contrary to the rules of the World Trade Organization, that where countries are meant to promise stable taxes or tariffs for all countries, treating them basically the same. But the US now is unhappy with the WTO because it says China doesn't play by the rules, which is not actually quite correct. But, of course, China has become a competitor for the US, so the US doesn't want to play the game anymore. It's thrown its toys out of the sandpit. But it's not just the US. Some other countries also have taken advantage of the US tantrum and are seeking to change the rules to benefit themselves as well.
And so if these changes to these rules go through, in full or in part, what sort of impacts would we see on the integrity of how the WTO can actually function, or just how it functions?
There was a very interesting speech by Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney at the recent World Economic Forum, who conceded that the rules of the WTO have always been skewed towards the interests of richer countries. And so there have been pressures from poorer countries for years to try to rebalance that process. What's happened now with the disruption that Trump has brought into the organisation is that the a whole range of countries are saying, oh, these are the changes to the rules that we want now. Unfortunately, developing countries' interests have been marginalised in that process, and richer countries, including New Zealand, have been saying we want new rules that, for example, don't require the consensus of everyone to agree to these global rules, that allow us to have subgroups making rules for ourselves on our favoured topics and so on. So the notion of a global regime is now being fractured but remade in the interests of richer countries, including, to some extent, New Zealand.
And with that said then, if we look towards these rule changes, are we likely to come out the other side as a winner in these changes, or are we likely to suffer as a result of this kind of regime or breaking down?
I think a cost-benefit analysis of these changes in the WTO misses the point. The point is that this was supposed to be a set of global rules that everyone would run by. If you start fracturing it and saying some countries will make rules amongst themselves, which is what's been happening with kind of free trade agreements, not the WTO, and if countries say they won't make rules on those that they don't like, which is mainly richer countries saying they don't want to level up the playing field for poorer countries, then we can effectively forget about the WTO. There will be no global set of rules. New Zealand is kind of trying to say, well, we can reshape some of these rules that might work better for us, but we don't want changes to others. It's a bit player in this process. It will basically take whatever the big players, the US, the EU, to some extent Australia, but it's mainly being driven by the US and the EU, whatever new global regime they want. And so New Zealand needs to think about whether this model itself is broken, and whether we need to think about different ways of approaching how we do trade rules and trade agreements, in particular in the context of things like the climate crisis and the major geopolitical changes happening in the world.
You've said that this will kind of impact our ability to react to the climate crisis appropriately. How can the collapse of the WTO, like how will this impact that urgent need to approach climate change?
The model the WTO works on is about trading in commodities to generate economic growth and profits. That is not a model that factors in the climatic destruction that we see from that model. And we've got it most recently in these arguments about mining of critical minerals and developing of deals on critical minerals, which we are told is a solution to the climate crisis, but in fact involves digging up the subsea structures and the land to pull out minerals, to process them, to produce electronic vehicles and so on. It doesn't address the fundamentals of the climate crisis of areas like food production or how we develop a level of self-sufficiency when transportation systems and so on are not viable. And so the model itself is not capable of dealing with this and in fact is exacerbating it. And that's part of the argument that's currently before the Waitangi Tribunal in the Climate Claim Priority Inquiry, where a Māori entity, Ngā Tōke Whakarururanga, is drawing these connections between the impacts for Māori that we're seeing just around the country now and the kind of antithetical model that these trade agreements promote.
With that said then, looking at how New Zealand should approach this, should we be concerned with kind of maintaining our and the WTO's integrity in the kind of trade space? Or is it kind of a how can we move forward in a way that isn't detrimental to the rest of the world, I guess?
Those of us like myself who've been critics of the WTO since it was established as being basically a rules-based system made by and for richer countries have said this kind of implosion was bound to happen and have been urging there to be a kind of first principles debate within Aotearoa on how we should address our own economy and our economic relations with other countries, as well as global rule setting. What we've had here for the last 30 years has been a very neoliberal or market-driven approach, which is partly what's behind the implosion, because it hasn't actually worked, and it's left a lot of people behind. We need to have a discussion now here, especially in the context of the climate crisis, about what the future should look like in our own domestic economy and how we trade with other countries and what are the kind of relationships that we want there. Unfortunately, we are a long way away from having those discussions, which are becoming more and more urgent.
Looking at those discussions and looking at the future of New Zealand in this kind of global trade space, is this kind of a wake-up call to rethink how we've approached neoliberalism in both the global and domestic spaces? Is this somewhere that we really should be paying attention for our own sakes?
When people look at what's happening in Trump land, often they focus just on the craziness of the president. But underpinning that is a recognition that the neoliberal model has failed. Markets benefit basically rich players, whether they're richer countries, but also richer corporations, and they leave people behind. They're also not suited for the climate crisis. They're not suited to balance social and development imperatives alongside those of profit. And so in Aotearoa, as in the US, we see many of these features. If we don't have the debate about alternatives now, we are going to be scrambling with more and more of these crises. So the collapse of the WTO, as it is rolling out, is another of these symptoms of a sick model that we really do need to revisit.
That was Professor Emeritus in Law at the University of Auckland, Jane Kelsey, on what the changing WTO may mean for New Zealand.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Durbidge, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
Whatever you call it,
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive. Thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
The original originator. Go to 95BFM.com for show podcasts.
Ah, guys, he finally asked me out. He says he knows a spot.
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no, what if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God, it's a beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95BFM Drive Show. A 3-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7pm every weekday only on 95BFM.
Thanks to the beer spot, your tappy place.
Affairs Current.
Richard, great question.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. That was Ghost in Your Bed by Bic Runger.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
The government's plans to construct a liquefied natural gas import terminal have sparked a lot of conversation over the past week about the role of natural gas in our energy infrastructure and what more we need. I spoke with Professor in Chemical and Material Engineering at the University of Auckland, Brent Young, about how this proposal fits into the issue it seeks to solve and what more needs to be done within our energy infrastructure if we mean to fix this. The government has moved towards this proposal to import liquefied natural gas through a new terminal. What does this actually mean?
Yeah, very good question. The idea behind importing LNG, it's one of several options that the government has been considering, and I would recommend that they consider some more, and looking to solve the dry year problem for New Zealand. So the dry year problem is when you have a year when you have a winter or a previous where the lake inflows, the hydro lakes, are very low. So we've had a and so when you require the energy in the winter, you just don't have the hydroelectricity to provide it. So you need to provide it somewhere else or somehow else. And that's where LNG can potentially come in.
With that in mind, is this what the government actually argues that the proposal would do for New Zealand? Like, what else is there in terms of their argument?
Okay, yeah. I guess their argument is that LNG is essentially a drop-in fuel, if you like, that can provide firming for that, for that situation where we have a cold, dry winter that perhaps is also sunless, and we just don't have the wind and solar available to provide the electricity that we need during the winter. So that's the argument. Now, LNG is not the only option. It's one of several options that the government's looked at and actually several that they've considered in detail. There are other options, and which, in fact, their briefing papers to Cabinet have mentioned. These include looking at using biomass, looking at using local diesel options, looking at even, and when I say biomass, also coal, local coal, and others which weren't considered, but pumped hydro for either the North or South Island, and other options such as distributed demand response.
And so looking at this option that the government did pick, is it the right move? Are there concerns about this move compared to the others?
Well, I think there are concerns, personally. My view is that we seem to be rushing into this decision. LNG is one of several options, as I've just mentioned. Many of the options that the government studied are actually lower cost compared to LNG. And in their own ranking, they actually rank quite similarly. LNG has, as I say, has perhaps the advantage that it could be deployed quickly, but we're not necessarily in a rush. Also, I think the estimate of having something ready for 2027 is ambitious, to say the least. There's also other issues around LNG that haven't been highlighted in the report. And there's security issues when tying into the LNG pipeline from overseas. LNG has been subject to quite a lot of volatility, because of the global tensions in the area. It also arguably is actually higher in greenhouse gas emissions than fuels like coal, even if coal's local. So because LNG is liquefied natural gas, so you're using a lot of energy to compress the gas to produce a liquid, and then at the other end, you then lose that energy when you take the liquid from the gas. So it's So it's a as a green fuel, it's not necessarily as green as one might think.
And so with that in mind, kind of looking at New Zealand's energy futures, how might this move kind of play into these futures? Is this a move that we should be concerned about when looking at our sustainability and our energy?
Yeah, I believe it is a move that, I mean, I think it's overdue that we do something about this. So from that perspective, I think the government's right to be taking action on this. But it's sort of part of this whole dry year problem. It's part of the whole wicked problem of energy in the modern world and providing security and energy so that doesn't affect climate change. And I think that LNG might be part of the solution, but I think it's there's lots of other parts of the solution that are currently need to be looked at, such as looking at decarbonisation of industry. In the meantime, we're missing that, although we did have it a few years ago. We're also missing a really good look at proper demand response initiatives around that. So I think there's more we could be doing in this area.
Looking at this kind of this current government, is this proposal for LNG, is this kind of a welcome pivot towards a new kind of energy, or does it feel like it's kind of entrenching some of the other energy and resource approaches from this government?
Yes, I mean, it's very much a political question, that one. But my personal view is that it does entrench or embed emissions and perhaps unintended consequences there. And I think that we as a trading nation that's going to be trading with the world, we've got to be seen to be clean and green if we want to sell our products overseas, and this is just one part of that equation. Having said that, this is planned for dry year response, so it shouldn't be the idea is that this is for insurance, that we shouldn't be running the LNG plant. In fact, the idea is that, hopefully, if we had demand response, if we had other ways of providing energy, then this would only be run as a backup in that dry year situation. However, we don't have those other alternatives at the moment, and so hence why I think we need a more of a comprehensive approach, a more considered approach to this problem.
I mean, on that then, what do you want to kind of see in terms of these other options and looking into these options from the government in terms of kind of building this robust dry year response in the future, going forward?
Yeah, I would like to see a little some more consideration taken. The challenge here, I think, too, is that this is a generational investment, and we seem to be rushing it. I would actually like to see a bipartisan approach taken on this, which could be difficult, sometimes the best things are difficult, and I would like to see a bit more time taken to this. There's no rush to try and get needed. We don't know that 2027 is going to be a bad year. I think we've got time to consider these other options in more detail and take a more considered approach. I think I would also add that I think it's actually, we require a multi-prong approach. I've talked about the wicked problem of climate change and energy provision in that. I think we need multiple solutions that can support each other, and so this sort of feels like a sort of one solution that where a government can tick a box and say they've done this, but in reality we actually need of a more of a considered pathway to solving this problem.
Next, I spoke to Professor Emeritus at Massey University, Ralph Sims, about the sustainability of liquid natural gas and potential alternatives. So the government's announced this new plan to import liquid natural gas and set up a facility for that. What is the issue that the government is trying to address with this policy?
Yeah, well, it's long-term shortages of electricity because of the climate situation, with dry years in particular, when the hydro schemes aren't full, when the hydro lakes aren't full. There's a difference between a daily shortage, because we heat have peak electricity demands in the evening, and so therefore everybody comes home from work, turns on the cooker, turns on the heater or whatever, and we have to reach that peak. You can't save electricity, you've got to generate it as people want it. And that's why we have a process where every half an hour, generators bid into a system to say how much electricity they can give. On a daily basis, we have these peaks we have to overcome, and so we have off-peak power situations and encourage people to charge their electric vehicles at night rather than during the day, those sort of things. But this is when we've got a longer-term deficit in the generation in trying to meet the demand. And there's various ways you can manage that. You can get companies, large companies, to turn their electricity demand off for some time. And that means that you get the balance between supply and demand. So the problem is that we need some form of energy storage so that we can turn the electricity on when it's needed, when the lakes are low. And people talk about the solar and the wind, and that's variable. It changes daily, and that's manageable, but it's more difficult when you've got a larger deficit.
Yeah, and LNG, I mean, it's been getting a bit of backlash, right, in the public?
Yeah, well, you think there's various ways you can store energy and ready to use it. So liquefied natural gas is one way of doing it, and so is coal. You can have a great big pile of coal. But both of these produce carbon dioxide in large amounts. And if you combust natural gas directly from the oil gas fields, then it produces about 200 grams carbon dioxide per kilowatt hour. And then you've got to add on for the transport and the processing, the extraction of that gas. So it's about 250 grams of CO2 per kilowatt hour. For LNG, liquefied natural gas, which has to be kept at a temperature below 160 degrees to keep it liquid so you can easily transport it, that's nearly double that amount of greenhouse gases per kilowatt hour generated. That's one problem. The other problem, of course, is the price that we would pay for it. And like oil prices or gas prices or coal prices, prices fluctuate. And there's a huge international demand for LNG now. About 12% of all the gas that's burnt in the world has been produced and transported as liquefied natural gas rather than being used locally through pipelines and such like. So therefore, we've got no idea what we'd be paying for it, and the cost of installing a storage and degasifying plant, you get a boatload of liquefied natural gas arrives. It has to be stored in heavily insulated tanks, and then when needed, it has to be gasified so that you can use the gas as you need it. There's a cost in doing that as well. And so the whole process is costly, and the price of LNG in the future is uncertain.
Finally, I spoke to the University of Auckland's Professor of Electrical Engineering, Nirmal Nair, about how energy companies stand to benefit from the LNG changes.
Well, currently what happens is electricity companies operate under a market system. We have been operating an electricity market since about late 90s, 1990s. So customers could go and look online. If you just type in electricity market prices, you can actually see every half an hour prices going up and down, right? So this is a wholesale price. So what you or I as customers, we pay, most of us pay through one person. Like if suppose you're staying in a home or a flat or whatever, usually you pay your electricity bill, right? Once in a month or something like that, and you get a bill, right? So so this is based on the meter, which that unit or that house has. So in New Zealand, we have about 2.4 million such meters, let us put it that way, ICPs, as they call it. So we pay the retail price, right? So we don't see the up and down and things like that. But if you wanted to look what the wholesale price is, if you go to their website, usually you will be seeing it, like it might move anywhere from 6 cents to 9 cents, something like that. But you or I might be paying to the retailer, let's say, anywhere between 30 cents to 38 cents. It depends upon what the retailer are, which part of the country you are in, and so on and so forth. So that's how the market has been operating for about, 30 years or something like that. So how does that work? Well, the generation companies, there are four of them now listed in the stock market. There used to be five, but now there is four. And these are what are called as generation companies. So they own these big, generation plant, which used to be owned by the public long time ago, but with the market, they just own. And they also have their retailer as well. So that's why it is called as gentailer. So for example, if you're Mercury, so Mercury is a generation company, plus it also has its retail arm. Similarly, Meridian and so on. So you can check that out, right? Plus there are some other people who don't own any assets, right? So they are just retailers. Now, what they do is they buy from wholesale. You have to pay the lines companies because electricity requires wires and cables and all those things. So then it comes and you have to pay some fixed charges to them, right? And it reaches you. Plus also on top of it, depending upon how you consume, you have GST and there are some levies and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, to put the story short, if suppose you're not into any of this market kind of mechanism, you or I, we would usually pay 30 to 39 cents, whatever that amount might be. So that's where that is. So currently, that market has been operating for a long time. So generation companies have, our major fuel is hydro, hydro plants, geothermal, and so on. Gas is just a small proportion of that exercise, right? So currently they are claiming that they're going to put actually a big storage plant for LPG. This is liquefied, it's called a CNG, right? So it's liquefied, but it is natural gas, but it is liquefied. So someone liquefies it and then through ships or something like that, they would get to us and then you store it. So this might not be useful for electricity land companies because it's very expensive fuel, right? So, but in New Zealand, we have a lot of people who uses gas, right? Gas and Fonterra plant uses those things. So that was my opinion that the CNG, whatever it is, it's of no use to us as customers. Why are we paying for that? Because that's not going to be done for electrification anyway. And the security of supply should be with the generation companies, with this existing fuel, right? So that is why they're using the same discussion and argument. 6 months ago, we had a coal storage. Again, they also it's going to be creating that, right? So I told, okay. So my opinion is this has no relevance to us. We are just paying the charges for the storage plant. Now, what would be the best advantage for us? Well, currently we are not part of the supply chain of the CNG in the globe. And as you know, the current climate around, the geopolitics and the fuel scarcity and what is going to happen. So we don't know what might happen in the fuel sector in the future. So the only advantage I can see is we will have a storage facility. We might store that. And, whenever the gas, we might use it for our own purpose or we might sell it off or something like that, right? But even in that case, that who will gain out of this whole exercise? It will be the generation companies, right? So in my opinion, this doesn't serve any purpose for us. Of course, the government can use its GST money or whatever it is to buy those containers to do it, but it might not have any relevance to us in the long run, right?
And the government's been talking about how it's going to help reduce power prices, especially at peak times, during the winter. During those hours when people are using their heaters, using their TVs, using whatnot. Is that something that is true, first of all? And is it worth the trade-off? We're spending $1 billion and it's also going into a levy on people throughout the year.
So that's where you have to know electrical engineering, right? So we're talking about peak load and here we're talking about energy. Energy is long-term, right? So that's why it's confusing, right? And I think it's disingenuous. That's what I kind of argue. No, this has nothing to do with this peak and things. So if you don't have energy, well, there will be scarcity, right? We might have to cut off those things. That's the only way. It's nothing to do with peak load. issues, right? Peak load is a different problem altogether. That is to do with the wires and this, which gets loaded up, right? And you can assume, right? If there is a congestion in the road, what happens? Everything stops, right? So you cannot have congestion in the electricity system because it will shut off, right? So it's not like that. So the peak load is really managing the load, but that would still require energy, right? So that is a different problem altogether. What the argument has been, well, you would have a lot of wind and solar and things like that, and it is intermittent, and this might provide security of supply. But currently, New Zealand doesn't have that much wind and solar, right? As I told you, it's hydro 65%, geothermal, and so on and so forth. So intermittency, I can agree, but peak load stuff can be managed by us managing our, you know, how we use our consumption and things like that. So that is no relevance to the gas issue. The argument here is the gas, because of the gas, our power prices might come down. Well, these are two different things, right? So I don't buy that argument because we don't produce that much electricity through gas anyway, right? The marginal cost on top is what it is. And currently it is coal. So coal prices are the expensive one, right? So gas is slightly more cheaper than the coal. But our gas is running out, which we have, and in those cases, most of the gas is being used by, currently in New Zealand, we use gas, right? So our own gas, which we produce. But we use it more for process plant, you know, for drying and things like that, which is Fonterra. So what you have to do as an educated person, you can just put a Google onto gas market in New Zealand, and there's actually a gas levy. And if you look at the customers, there are customers, right? You know, there are three or four companies which produces gas, and who consumes gas is basically, there used to be a company called as Methanex, which used to produce using gas, but they haven't gone out of business. It was a Canadian company. They just closed because they knew the gas is running out here because it was cheap gas, right? And the other big customer is Fonterra for drying its milk plant and so on and so forth. So actually, electricity use directly through gas is less at this point of time. And that is running out anyway. So therefore, we can't rely on gas even for electricity anyway, right? So I think, and we have hydro and this and so on and so forth. So our electricity mixture is a different thing. But the thing New Zealanders usually pay, you know, we fear of our taxpayers, right? You have to pay your taxes, otherwise it'll be a problem. And all of us pay for our electricity. So electricity seems to be the easiest way for people to charge money, right, fairly to everyone. That is why they are adding that levy on top of it, right? So you add GST, you add those things. Everyone pays the same rate, right? I mean, to say, as per say, consumption and those things. So they're just adding the levy so everyone pays for it, right? It's almost like a road user tax or something like that. So my argument has been, well, if this plant with the gas is going to be used by electricity and they're going to be run by generation companies, why don't they pay for it? If they're not paying for it, let the government pay for it. It has GST anyway, right?
Those were Professor in Chemical and Material Engineering at the University of Auckland, Brent Young, Professor Emeritus at Massey University, Ralph Sims, and the University of Auckland's Professor of Electrical Engineering, Nirmal Nair, speaking up about various aspects of the liquid natural gas program and the various issues that might occur.
Combinations of the feeling for straight. To keep me out of phase, yeah. That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rahina Monday. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The ACT Party's Simon Court, Professor Emeritus at the University of Auckland Jane Kelsey, the University of Auckland's Professor Brent Young, Professor Emeritus at Massey University Ralph Sims, and the University of Auckland's Professor Nirmal Nair. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongoana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The 1 to 4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.